Welcome to Nonprofits, March 1st, 2017. We have a shorter podcast. We're going to talk a little bit about Trump's pivot and the forecasting value of that kind of thing. I do want to, we are in media res. We're having a discussion about things Wikipedia is good and bad at. I think there are certainly some topics where a Wikipedia entry can be very meandering. You can get a lot of people who are sort of indulging their pet theories. But Robert, you offered one, if you want to formalize it, that you think Wikipedia is very good at.
Yeah, I think Wikipedia is amazing. If you want to know the history and all the different iterations of a comic book character, if you want to know who the maestro is, it is unbelievably complete, as far as I can tell, fairly accurate. I mean, if I wanted to know about, say, Wittgenstein, it's got some stuff in there. But if I want to know who, you know, the Spider-Girl is, perfect. It's great.
I did this. It's funny that you mentioned it, because you're absolutely right. I went to see the Deadpool movie last year, and I was like, I don't know who any of these people are. So I started looking it up, and it's A, it's a rabbit hole. B, it is the most detailed. That, I mean, it is people who say, like, I imagine if people devoted the same, and I hate to be that guy, but I'm going to be that guy. If people devoted the same attention, time, and consideration to their civic duties as they do to thumbing through the Mylar bags, making certain that a Wikipedia entry on Logan's healing factor post his Hulk fight is accurately represented, we would be much better off as a civilization. Now, having said that, I don't want to knock nerds, because I do actually want to go see Logan.
So one of the things that I've thought with Wikipedia, and this is maybe just my perverse brain, but so this isn't quite Wikipedia, but the city that I live in is a major tourist destination for this little region of the world, and it's, I have no idea, but hundreds of thousands of tourists, you know, for it basically, you know, far the number of tourists far exceeds the population here throughout the year, and
right,
and so I thought, okay, if I typed in something on Wikipedia about this city,
wait, let me pause you for a second. Why? What is it about your
the city? The city is a medieval city. The center of the city is a walking zone. It was the European capital of culture in 2007. So once a year, they pick like which city in Europe to represent for culture. So it has a Saxon history. So basically medieval times. It has basically a Saxon. So it was one third Saxon up until 1989, which is basically German sort of, you know, basically has this old history that's incredible. And there's still a lot of fortified, there's a fortified wall still all around the town. It's just quite intact. So that it's beautiful. It's a really beautiful place. And
what about Dracula?
About that at all? Seriously, that's far away from here. So, yeah, yeah.
A wall would not stop him, Robert.
Yeah,
fair point.
So,
it's a fair
so
point.
That's not the point here. So, although I know that people who have tourist businesses here, if they mention anything about haunted tours or whatever, they'll be full all day long. They'll have no problem getting people. But that's not the main reason people come here that sure. are, you know, from Europe. But it is one reason. But it's like surrounded by mountains. It's a beautiful natural place, whatever. But regardless, it's a tourist place that enough people have gone through that there are going to be a lot of entries in Wikipedia. There are going to be a lot of photos. There's going to be a lot of people who, if you type something weird about it that was just a lie, it would get filtered out really quickly. There's also an active, you know, active tourist
sure.
department here, you know, city hall, whatever. So it wouldn't work. But if you took some really small village, there may be no entries. I have no idea. I don't know how small a place has to become to have no entries. But certainly people who come and visit this place right. from America, most probably don't know much about it. And I've given a lot. I'm not obviously, and you'll know why I say not obviously, but I'm obviously not an official tourist guide, even though I've given a lot of tours. And I thought people probably don't really care, unless they're historians. Most people probably don't care about absolute truth and just really want to hear a good story. And so I thought, when I'm walking through the town, I do when I right. know the dates, I'll say, yeah, this was, you know, 1348 or something. But
do you make up fake news?
No, let me finish.
He just made up really funny stories. You know, people will remember it. They'll be like, yeah, this is great. You know,
That's awesome.
Yeah, I know I can't use words like, you know, Bubba did something over here because that doesn't sound very Saxon. But if I basically made up a story that sounded plausible,
right.
people would be like, wow, you know, this is incredible. And they have no way of knowing. Yeah.
I'm a little disillusioned.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm the exact opposite. Scott, I know you're an excellent forecaster. You're an excellent writer. You're a very good critical thinker. I've never been more proud of you that I am right now.
Well, I have mixed feelings.
Well, it's kind of like me teaching my kids the wrong words. So for a long time, my kids. Yeah. But it's great because they're not growing up around that's English so speakers. Good. So they point at their elbow and say ankle, and they point at their ankle and say elbow. And yeah. But they're 10, you know, that's.
Yeah, no, you're right. They're all joints.
Yeah.
They're going to have a hard time at the doctors.
I finally realized this is probably not going to be funny anymore. So I am. Yeah, I finally did start to unlearn them.
What are they? They're like 17, right, yeah. 18 now.
Right. Yeah, but basically it's like just the issue of small numbers. So if there are hundreds or thousands of people reviewing an item, it's likely to be pretty accurate. You know, so even if you typed in, you know, a very charged subject like President Barack Obama, you know, obviously there are people with a lot of different views, but probably the wiki is going to be relatively accurate about him. But the like mayor of a small village, maybe nothing listed. So you could really have fun with it.
They have, I remember reading a couple of papers on it. Just because I was interested in the method they use to screen for trolls. Yeah, Wikipedia actually has a very sophisticated set of algorithms they use to flag. And you're exactly right. There are certain ones that are going to just get enough traffic that people prune away bad information. But they're also very good at identifying in advance topics that may be more likely to attack trolls. They're good at identifying the kind of language trolls use and spotting them in advance, limiting their access, and also making certain that editors are quick to jump on any changes to make certain that there aren't any kind of inaccuracies and stuff like that. So we weren't actually talking about Wikipedia. One of the things that we do want to talk about is Trump's pivot, because it's interesting. Scott, you had mentioned this in advance of the podcast, and Robert and I were talking about it before we started recording. Trump gave a speech last night, or was it the night before last? Was it last night? I think it was last night. His State of the Union address, I think that's how it was formally being billed. And it was praised by a lot of people as a pivot, because he read from a teleprompter. It was a much more sort of measured speech. He didn't use the same kinds of dark goth phrases that he used.
American carnage.
Yeah, exactly. Bathed in blood. Your children, blood will be spitting from their eyes and ears.
Blood alone moves the wheels of history.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It was not like a GWAR song that he was just sinking into a microphone in a bass voice. He gave a sort of uplifting speech. He at least mentioned, not even obliquely, but just briefly, the attack in Kansas City on the Indian gentleman, which actually I have a friend in Kansas City, and it rattled him because he lives near the bar where the guy came in. As the story, if the listener isn't aware, there was a story in Kansas City recently of two Indian engineers who I believe worked for Garmin. There actually is a kind of burgeoning tech sector in Kansas City, in part because Google made it one of the Google Fiber places.
He, I would say, mentioned it a little bit obliquely. He said basically the attack in Kansas City. He didn't say the, you know, attack against, it ended up not being an attack against Muslims. It actually ended up being attacks against an Indian, but somebody who thought they were attacking Iranians, right. And probably thinking, well, which Iranians can be Muslim, but he didn't do that. Where if it's radical, he likes to say radical Islamic terrorists all the time. And he didn't try to reverse it this other way and say, right. You know, attacks on our, you know, on Muslims.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't a robust description of that attack.
Correct.
But it was an acknowledgement of it. And there was an acknowledgement of the anti-Semitic attacks as well. These are vandalism in Jewish cemeteries. And so a lot of people said, oh, it was a pivot. It was a turning point we've all been waiting for. And one of the things that I think interests me and interests all of us is, what are events that actually have, that are material from a forecasting perspective? Like, what's a thing we can look at and say, if there's a related forecast, like something that Trump might do, something, some kind of military action or political action, does this have any probative value? But before that, Scott, you were talking about a reaction to the speech, and I wanted you to say it because I hadn't heard it before.
I don't have the exact words, but Van Jones from CNN said that at the moment, actually, where he gave the salute to the fallen soldier, to Owens from the Yemen raid, right. That he gave a salute to him. And even though that raid obviously in some ways went wrong in the sense that the person died, but even there are questions about how much intelligence value was there in the raid. We probably will never know the answer to that. But regardless, that he would acknowledge this guy. And part of the background on this was that the man's father didn't want to, you know, meet or talk to Trump when the body arrived. He actually didn't want to make a political deal about it, but he was just like, I don't really want to see him right now. Yeah, so Trump mentioned this guy as a fallen hero and saluted his his wife who was there, and also saluted that he got the biggest applause of the night, which was strange that the guy would be looking down and realizing he got the biggest applause. So I guess it was worth it, but that wasn't exactly his words. It was worth it, but it seemed to be the point. But regardless, Van Jones said at the moment that he mentioned Owens, this fallen soldier, he became the president of all Americans, or all of America.
It's just the superficial view of what being a president means is remarkable. Like, I'm not saying that Trump didn't behave differently in the speech, and I'm not saying that maybe that doesn't tell us something about how Trump might behave in the future, but really, like, just giving one prepared speech about one event.
In this case, it was like because of one sentence. Okay, you say one sentence and it's fine. This is actually absurd. Okay, it could be, this is one of the things we do deal with a lot in forecasting, in formal forecasting, is we'll look at individual events, and a lot of times people who are not as practiced in forecasting will say, wow, look, it's a change. And then all of a sudden their forecast will change by, 50%. Like, oh, this is, mind-blowing. And most of the time, events don't actually change forecasts very much. And there's also the idea that if you wanted to forecast any question and you just stayed with status quo is almost always the right answer. I shouldn't say almost always, but by the vast majority of the time, status quo is, better than the coin flip.
Except maybe when Trump is president. I mean, he really is shaking things up.
So one of the things we do is try to look at base rates. This is the boring technical parts, but during the election, there was one week basically before the actual election where they seem to have taken away his Twitter ability. I don't know whether they actually, how that happened. They took his phone.
Made him wear mittens.
Yeah. And he was attempting to read from a teleprompter. And I felt kind of like in that week, we had the Trump of last night, the neutered Trump. And it obviously, it didn't last very long, So once again, is this pivot from last night just, okay, he saw sinking poll numbers. He knows there's dissension in the Republican Party, and he just gave, managed to sit down and read read a speech that was kind of canned, or has he really, it's possible that he came across a lot of realities. Like he said, it's unbelievable how complicated, I'm paraphrasing, but it's unbelievable how complicated healthcare is.
I don't even think that's a paraphrase. I think that's verbatim.
He said, who knew or no one knew or something.
It's like, no one knew. Super complicated.
I think if you're forecasting Trump's behavior going forward, I think that this adjusts your forecast slightly, but not very much. It shows that they're at least willing to respond cosmetically to criticisms, which may be new. They weren't always willing to do that. But we do have a lot of other data points. A lot of the policy changes weren't really that substantive. I don't think that you completely change your idea about who Trump is, because we've seen a lot of Trump now. We have a pretty good sense of where he's going.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's the way it was covered in the press, as if it was just this radical sea change, to me is so discordant. That was just sort of my own understanding of the situation, but from forecasting in general, for all the points you guys have made, we have this huge body of evidence prior to this one speech. And now there's this idea that he read a teleprompter with only minimal ad-libbing. That is a deep ocean trench bar that he's managed to float over. And now we're saying, yeah, he's a high jumper. It just has to have very little, for me, very little probative value. But Robert, I think you're exactly right. There's some, there is this idea that, because we can't imagine a State of the Union speech where he is just winging it. And the fact that that's not the case, I do think means something, but I don't know how much it means. So one of the things, Robert, that you mentioned was there was a piece, a story recently about North Korea, and there's a leak about possible action in North Korea. And before you give the details on that, prior to the speech, let's assume we had a particular probability we assigned to the event that in the next 2 years, there is some kind of American military action in North Korea. After this speech, do you guys think the speech would affect that kind of probability at all?
I would say if I thought before this speech that the probability, this is not the true probability I would give it, but if I said the probability was 40% before the speech that we would have a direct military conflict with North Korea, then I might say, okay, after the speech, I will go down to 37 from 40, or not even that, maybe down to 38. I would move it just a few points.
Why? Because you think he is willing to be restrained?
Part of this is because almost nothing exists completely in a vacuum. So the speech was also coming for me at the exact same time that he was announcing other things that he was going to do. Like he was going to do the rollout of the immigration ban number two. The first one basically got knocked down, and that one's been delayed. Right. So he still hasn't been able to come up with a quick immigration banned very quickly at all. You know, a lot of other a lot of things that he wanted to do, he hasn't been able to do. And so I think he has, you know, at the same time that the speech is coming out, he's also, you know, passed a month being president and run into some of the walls of presidential power, some of the limits of presidential power. And so I think that, you know, even for somebody who, you know, let's say potentially has narcissistic personality disorder, there still may be some point where either he's silenced, the people around him silence him. I don't know what happens, but, you know, so, and I can't separate that out from the speech. The speech didn't happen in a vacuum. If it happened in a vacuum, then I might give it, you know, even less value. But because it did happen around other events, I might, you know, lower it, as I say, like 3% or something.
I think it's worth mentioning that when we adjust our forecast, I mean, I think this is true for me. You can tell me if it's true for you guys as well. I often adjust it just a tiny amount, 1 or 2%. Now, sometimes I don't know if that, like, tweaking it really makes a big difference. But usually I think big moves aren't called for unless there's news that we're about to attack. You don't adjust your estimate that much.
Yeah, I think so. There's one event I can think of recently in GGI where I really adjusted my forecast, and I haven't come down yet because I'm not convinced that the underlying factors aren't still there. But I mean, you guys are exactly right. By and large, it's minor adjustments, barring an event that is clearly both impactful / material and is likely to have enduring effects. And those are rare. And they're either, in fact, you know, we were talking before the podcast, there are black swan events, which are unpredictable. And then there's another term, dragon king events, which are sort of possibly predictable, but also outlier significant events. But whether you're talking black swans or dragon kings, they're very rare events. And most of the time, it's incremental. And this was Obama's frustration with government in general, maybe not frustration, but his description of government, which is, it's like moving an ocean liner, like you're moving a few degrees at a time.
I can give a few examples of things that would create a major shift in the forecast. So, for instance, in North Korea, we already know that they have nuclear weapons. And there's a question about whether they could actually put it on a missile that would reach the United States, or, you know, including Hawaii. And if we knew, yes, they just reached that point.
Just a FYI, buddy.
Really appreciate it.
Those of us who don't live in Hawaii sometimes don't really consider the main, you know, it's really only the mainland that counts. No.
You're in range of Soviet tanks.
Yeah, that's right.
You are, yeah. Yes. I am fine. Like, the only thing that's going to get me is mosquitoes.
So I would think, like, if they just tested a missile and it landed, you know, I don't know, in Antarctica, they sent something very far, you know, that may precipitate a reaction. If North Korea obviously invaded South Korea, occasionally they've had border disputes, but if they did a major attack, there's certain things you'd say, okay, this really pushes it up. If there was actually, if impeachment actually had started, so if Congress started impeachment, obviously, you know, as a Republican-led initiative, then all of a sudden I'd be like, wow, a lot of our forecasts are really, really need to be revisited, because now we have, you know, fundamentally different rules that we're going to be going by. You know, but day-to-day things, no, it's not going to change it that much.
How would it change your forecast if North Korea assassinated someone with a nerve gas with a weapon of mass destruction in Malaysia?
Very, very little.
All right, good. Just hypothetically.
Well, I mean, this is one of those bad things about knowing technicalities. So one issue we get into is technicalities. And so the particular nerve gas that was used in North Korea.
I can't believe you're being fussy about nerve gas, Scott.
No, there's a reason.
Keep going. I want to hear this.
It's a liquid. Yeah, and that's what I wanted to comment on it. So VX is an oil. It was an oil. It's basically something the consistency of baby oil.
Can you distribute it through a super soaker?
Yeah. So if you have some super soaker, yeah. So if you could get some truck, or probably, I shouldn't say things like this, but probably if you could get it in a crop duster, you know, and spray over someplace, you could do some serious damage. But it would take something pretty complicated to do it. Now, that's certainly possible. But even then, it's going to be only things that come in immediate contact with it. So that would be very different to me than spreading a biological weapon in some ways that may be able to spread through a society much quicker.
Sure, but it's classified as a weapon of mass destruction, and I think technically violates the convention on certain weapons.
But all of their conventional weapons on the border, near the DMZ, but could essentially mass destruct a lot of South Korea. So, you know, so for me, to some degree, as far as a threat to South Korea, the biggest threat to South Korea now is probably conventional, you know, mortars and missiles.
Well, the biggest threat to South Korea is if we take action against North Korea, right? Like, that's when South Korea and Japan are upset.
And you said there was a story today from the, ostensibly from the Trump White House, saying this, we are considering this. I remember seeing something a couple of days ago where someone had reported that Trump viewed North Korea as the number one current threat to the United States. I don't know how true that is, but that's the report I read.
Yeah. So supposedly sources told the Wall Street Journal that the White House is considering different strategies. And one of the strategies that's on the table is military force or regime change. And this isn't really particularly a surprise. These strategies are always on the table. I'm sure they always talk about right. them. But the fact that someone leaked it either accidentally, which is a pretty big deal, or deliberately to send a message to North Korea, South Korea, China, Japan, that is kind of a big deal. But apparently, according to the article, and I don't know the details of this, the U.S. has been talking about the possibility of military action with its allies as well. So maybe this is at least some message they're sending. Whether or not it's serious, they would seriously consider it, I don't know.
So related to military action, there have been a couple of other stories this week around the time of the Trump State of the Union address. The first was the Yemen attack, or the Yemen raid. I don't know quite how you characterize it. Failed raid. I think NBC reported that it was not successful. There was no useful intelligence that came out of it, or not much. The White House has said it was enormously successful. We have good information for days. Like, we're swimming in it. Who knows quite what the truth is, but prior to the State of the Union address, there's an interview with Trump where he was asked about it, and he essentially seemed to push the blame onto his generals. I think their quote was something like, "I have the best generals. Everybody can see it." And I wish this wasn't close to verbatim, but this is close to what he said. "I have the best generals. I think that's true. They came to me with this.
They wanted to do this.
Yeah, they did it, and they lost Ryan." I think that was the quote, something like that. And it certainly sounds as if he's sort of passing the buck and saying, "This says, you know, these guys did it. Obama had planned it," which is sort of true, even though the Trump White House had opportunity to veto it and decided to go along with it. But he seems to be sort of disclaiming blame himself. And then there was a report today that the Trump White House, in combination with the Pentagon, is considering changing the chain of command so that there are certain military actions the president doesn't have to sign off on, that some of his subordinates can sign off on. I think particularly in Syria, but maybe in other countries as well. I don't remember the details, or if the details weren't quite that specific, but there's an idea of changing the chain of command so that Trump doesn't, he will be briefed on material events. He's removing himself.
So I'm wondering, is he going to have something on his desk saying the buck stops there?
Yeah, where's the buck? I think it's a Roomba. I think he will put the buck on a Roomba, right, and just let it go through the White House. Like, where's the buck? I don't know.
I mean, I don't know how long you can sustain I disavow the things my administration does strategy. Like,
it's very weird.
The Bay of Pigs was an Eisenhower plan, right? And I guess that maybe a JFK took out the air support or something to make it less effective. But nobody blames Eisenhower for that. We remember the Bay of Pigs as Kennedy.
And Kennedy himself took the blame for it.
Right. Well, yeah.
So it's definitely a little strange. But my question is, a lot of people have, and again, I want to view this through the prism of the Trump pivot, which I think we're all skeptical of as being a meaningful event, or as being a substantially meaningful event, maybe sort of trivially or minor meaning to it. But in combination with what we are sort of learning about possibility of military action, the idea that a lot of people have, which is that Trump has surrounded himself with military figures to an unusual level. But they're respected people. McMaster.
Mattis.
Yeah, and Mattis are two who are very well respected.
You know, that is kind of a pivot.
Yes, that is.
That itself.
Is it better or worse? Or do you think, like, is the probability of successful military action if Trump deliberately removes himself from a lot of the processes, do you think it's higher or lower that we will engage in military action, and higher or lower that it will be
successful?
I think
it depends on whether he truly has removed himself. So if the...
Let's assume for the sake of argument, he has removed himself from everything. Let's say they divide it into four tiers, and anything that is below the 75th percentile, he's just like, look, you guys can handle it. If it's this top level, you know, we're deploying a lot of troops or whatever, let me know and I'll sign off on it. But you guys can handle the rest. Is that better or worse when it comes to military
support? Well, we would assume that it's better because we're assuming that he doesn't make the best choices, I think.
Yeah, that's my feeling. Like, I trust McMaster a little bit more. You know, I don't know if he's the guy I would pick necessarily, but if you were stuck with him as your national security advisor, you'd be okay with that.
But did you also want someone who is thinking, A, is thinking of politics, and B, is what's not, because of, unfortunately, bone spurs, is not part of the military, is not immersed in the military culture? Like, don't you want someone who doesn't think, and, you know, I've read, and I'm sure we've all read the same pieces, about how these are sort of like philosopher warriors. They are all people who have seen war and are not anxious to re-experience it, that they will use the military in a kind of sober, responsible way. Maybe, but it does seem like one of the hallmarks of our country is the way it's civilian control of the military.
No, I agree. I agree, but we're talking about Trump. Like, that's the
no,
thing.
I know,
it's like,
I know. And for you, the if we
have
to choose.
We're also speaking about very specific generals that we actually have a long history of knowing their writings, their speeches, and some of their actions. So like with the case of McMaster, as an acting general, obviously he had to take commands and follow commands, but we also know a lot about his writing and his philosophy and his view of how he sees a lot of the world as a very complicated place. So he's not seeing easy answers, and he's not seeing easy military answers. So I think in the case of knowing his philosophy, his speeches compared to Trump's, I would be much more comfortable with him making the decision, because I'm not in this case just leaving it with any random general. And I don't know enough about random generals to say if you just took the aggregate of 100 generals, would they be more militaristic than Trump or not? I don't know. But in the case of McMaster, I would say, you know, probably not. And I think he understands nuances. And one nuance that I wanted to get into, because we were talking about North Korea, is every year there's an exercise of South Korea and the U.S. There may be other allies involved, but for sure with South Korea and the U.S. And it's called Full Eagle. And last year there were 15,000 U.S. soldiers taking part in it. This year they said it'll be roughly the same number. And this apparently every year really, really angers the North, and they're always afraid that this is really just a precursor to an invasion. So the statements that were leaked saying that, you know, that there's basically a plan to invade them coming at almost the same time as this exercise is a lot more destabilizing probably than even just some random leak during, you know, regular calm times with an ally that, you know, we're with, let's say just with some country that we had fairly good relations with. So it's already a tense place with a leader of the other country that appears to be, you know, also somewhat impetuous. So it's, you know, those are really dangerous circumstances. You know what I think? Where I think mistakes can easily be made.
So how are you thinking about military action right now? Like, given what we've seen over the last few days from the Trump administration, if you are forecasting not geopolitical events in general, but specifically the U.S. military playing a role in various events. Do you look at North Korea now, and let's assume for the sake of argument this report is true, and Trump is removing himself from a lot of the decision making, and I don't know if it's limited to a particular region, so let's just say it's not, that he just wants to say, don't bother me with these military actions, just sort of generally go and fulfill my vision. If that's true, how do you forecast military activity now? Like, do you just familiarize yourself with the work of these generals, or do you just sort of, like, you know what I mean? Like, what's the philosophy when you're approaching forecasting American military activity? If the chain of command now is much murkier than it's traditionally been.
Well, you just gave the example of 75th percentile. And if you look at something like 75th percentile, and if we say that's the commitment of large numbers of troops, it may not only be large number of troops that would actually in time result in large numbers of troops going to war. So for instance, in North Korea, an easy solution in the short term would be to say, okay, let's go ahead and do a strike against known nuclear facilities, against known facilities that are developing rockets. And in the past, that's been done effectively in certain countries. It's been done effectively against Iraq by the Israelis a long time ago to hit a nuclear reactor. It's also been done by the Israelis against a Syrian nuclear reactor that was starting. And so if somebody had the idea, okay, we can hit two or three places, we don't even necessarily have to say we did it, because like when Israel hits places, a lot of times they don't mention it at all. And they basically through back channels give the word that we're not going to say anything, because we know if it's publicly said that we attacked you and you're unable to stop us, that's destabilizing to your regime. So we're just going to hit this place. It's going to be quiet. Oh, not in that spot, but in your country, it's going to be quiet. And then you're going to know game over on a certain military plan or that you're doing, this may work, but it would also have really a giant chance that North Korea would react and end up, you know, attacking South Korea over it. And yet it would have been something that fell, you know, beneath our 75% chance.
Yes. So, no, I agree with that.
There's no way, I don't know what the percentile means exactly, but there's no way that Mattis or McMaster are ordering a strike on North Korea without presidential approval.
Right.
I mean, they wouldn't do that even if he said, go ahead, you have the authority to.
Right.
There's no way, because it's a political issue, and because
compared to, like,
they'd be court-martialed.
Being in Syria right now, there's the battle in Mosul. And if it was about, are we going to use a AC-130, basically the airplane that's very, very destructive, and say we're going to take out one neighborhood because we know this neighborhood basically has sort of the dead enders from ISIS in it, and there are going to be some civilian casualties. Maybe they could make that call without the president's involvement and somehow get away with it.
Yeah, I think a point that you were making, Scott, which I think is true, though, is you're right, Robert. I think there are certain decisions that are sort of prima facie big decisions that they're not going to make on their own. But assuming this story is true, or this is where we're trending, where Trump is removing himself from the chain of command for certain military decisions, we can imagine decisions that may not by themselves reach that threshold, but could clearly could force a hand.
Yes.
Sure, we could see a crisis happening.
Yeah, it could result in something that's going to suddenly kick it into that top 25th percentile. And so for me, if that's the way things are trending, I think it's very, and this is an unsatisfying answer because I don't really know. I've thought about it a little bit, I haven't thought about it a lot. I think it'll be much harder to predict military activity. On the one hand, I have the same response you guys do, which is, okay, if he just knows this is not something I'm good at, I don't want to take the heat for it. I want to be able to.
He's not a detail guy.
He's not a. He is a super large vision guy, which is to say, he is just large letters on something guy. But it's entirely the case. He's like, I don't want responsibility for this. I don't want to make the decisions. I want to be able to blame somebody if things go wrong. But I think it's going to be hard to set a level and say below this, I don't want to know, and think that the things that are below that threshold won't necessarily rise above the threshold eventually. Like, the collateral effects may push it into a level where it's something that he would need to have been notified for. And so I think that I think it's probably hard to isolate a military event in terms of what the consequences are going to be, I think it's going to be hard to predict, if this is how things go, military action. But I think it's going to be murky. I think it's going to be much murkier than it is now, where we have a clear chain of command.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think actually that if Trump were making the decisions, it might be much more erratic. But in general, like, I suspect that Obama, he may have been the decision maker, but I suspect he followed the advice of those military advisors. Yeah, I suspect, because it's not his expertise, because there's a lot of details. So I suspect that he didn't overrule their impulses that often. So I think that it'll more or less go like a normal administration if Trump is not sticking his fingers in there all the time. That's my guess. I think it might actually be easier.
If I take Trump out of the equation, which doesn't really make sense because he is in the equation, but if I look historically, there are cases, for instance, the Cuban Missile Crisis, where there was I don't know if it's just one general or some of the generals were wanting to attack Cuba directly, which was considered that would have actually been a wrong decision, and Kennedy pushed back against that. We have another case in the war with, with Serbia, where General Wesley Clark wanted actually to, basically there was an airfield that Russians had already gotten to before we got to it. We didn't think that was going to happen. And he was wanting to actually go ahead and just kick them out, like either kick them out, or if they don't kick them out, if they don't go, we would basically shoot them. And apparently somebody on the ground there, like the general on the ground who was getting that order, was like, I'm not doing that. You know, so basically, like, somebody resisted. There's also the case during the Cuban Missile Crisis where there was a Russian submarine commander who refused to basically launch a strike against an American ship, which they thought, also may have precipitated World War III. So there are cases where military people have either blocked an order that possibly could have made things spiral out of control, or where the president has blocked it, in the case of Kennedy with the Cuban Missile Crisis. So if I look at it, separate from who Trump is, then I can say, the military has sometimes been the brake and sometimes been the gas, depending on who's there. And the same with the presidents.
Right.
So, but I would agree with Robert that in the case of Donald Trump, I think that he is erratic enough that I would, if I could hand it over to one wise philosopher or warrior, if there is, you know, then I would be,
right.
Yeah, I would prefer that. Yeah. I wouldn't want it to be precedent. I wouldn't want to say this is a good rule for all presidents to follow.
Right.
So that's what worries me. It's one of the hallmarks of our political process, or as someone in Reddit put it, democracy 1.0, which is showing its age, is we have a ton of veto points. And sometimes that's bad. Sometimes that's good. For military action, I think it's good. And the more you shorten the process, for me, I feel like it's inherently more dangerous, inherently more unstable. Even though Trump is another chain in that process, or would be another chain in that process.
I'm concerned about the marginalization of the State Department. I mean, I think the State Department should be involved in these decisions. They're getting shut out of the National Security Council. They're cutting their staff if they want to. These are the people that should be heavily involved in these decisions.
Yes. Well, I mean, a lot of people said, where's Tillerson? I think the budget that Trump proposed, was it 25% or 30% of the State Department?
Yeah.
It was a gutting. Whatever the proposal was, it would decimate the State Department. And as a lot of people have pointed out, Trump seems to really undervalue soft diplomacy and the idea that we can get so much more of an advantage by helping someone with a certain amount of money as opposed to forcing someone to do something. Even though empirically that's the case. Like you can make investments in communities and they will pay off so much more than going in and telling someone to do something.
Or even just understanding how to get along with someone.
Yeah, he seems to undervalue diplomacy quite a bit.
Knowledge on the ground.
Yes.
The kinds of things that they don't, the perspective that they wouldn't get just from a military commander, no matter how nuanced they are.
One of my areas of both concern and area of study is understanding deep knowledge of countries compared to what we may know just, you know, being raised in the West. And so I give the example of even where I live. So where I live at one point was under Ottoman rule. And because it was under Ottoman rule, which essentially is Turkey, there's a certain feeling that if I had a lot of Turkish students here, people like the Turkish students who were around, but the idea of having any sort of possibility of Turkish influence on a political level here is just really abhorrent. And even though this, you know, the rule was more than 100 years ago, people still have this really visceral reaction to that group, or they may have a visceral reaction to Hungarian rule because they had Habsburg, you know, rule up until right before World War One. You know, so if history is like this, if somebody doesn't understand that and gets involved in, you know, in something that may lead to war, you're really like running half blind.
Right. I mean, this is the Iraq problem.
You know, I've also given the example that in America, I don't think many people care about the War of 1812. I don't think we're saying, oh, the Brits attacked us. Oh, those, you know, those dirty Brits, you know, like maybe it's because we won the war. I don't know what the reason is, but basically it's not factoring much into our view of that country, of UK. But in some places going back 800 years, people have deep hostilities that are still there. And so those situations should be taken into account. And if you have a decimated State Department, and if you also have a decimated intelligence community, or even if you fully funded them but just ignored them, I think you do that really at great peril.
Yeah, I think that's right. Before we wrap up, there was a New Yorker piece today, or no, a couple of days ago, two or three days ago. It revisits the simulation hypothesis, the idea that we all live in a simulation, and it suggests that there's new evidence that suggests we live in a simulation, and it is three recent bizarre events, salient events. They are Trump's election, the Atlanta Falcons losing the Super Bowl when they had a more than 99% chance of winning at one point, and the flub at the Oscars, which has never happened before, which is also just very, very bizarre. And this was the quote, New Yorker quote, these bizarre events put one in mind of a simple but arresting thesis. We're living in the Matrix, and something has gone wrong with the controllers. Thoughts? It's half joking, although the simulation hypothesis is a real idea.
And that's not the argument for it.
No,
that stuff is weird. That's not it.
No. Okay, but agree. What I will say, though, is it's going forward for this year. Certainly, there have been a lot of very weird events. And a lot of people just, you know, jokingly compared the Oscar flub to Trump and the election. The idea that we thought one person would win, actually someone else came out. And one, we've seen the pivot. We've seen the idea that the White House is arguing, okay, we found our footing, we're learning, we're actually going to be much more presidential going forward. What do you guys think for the coming year, let's say, you know, the next 9 months. How likely do you think it is there's going to be a just a weird outlier event in this presidency? And do you think it's more likely because of Trump? I'm not even sure this is a gimme question. Like, it feels like a gimme as I ask it, but I don't know if it means, okay, things are going to stabilize, or we can actually expect a weird event, a weird significant event to happen in the next 9 months.
I think we can expect, I mean, I don't say like 100%, but like there's a higher chance of a weird significant event because of what Trump appears to be doing. I don't think that relates to what happened at the Oscars, but I also think that we may be overfit, that we make these patterns in our head. Weird stuff happens all the time.
Yeah, that's right.
Sometimes it's prominent and we notice a cluster of those things and it sticks in our head. But really, like, one in a billion things are happening in your day all the time. It's just there are billions of little events.
If you flip a coin 10 times, probably that sequence.
I've heard to see which of those things are actually linked and which of them are just completely random. So to me, the Oscars and the football are completely random. But if I looked at
the Warriors lost in last year's playoffs.
I forgot about the Warriors.
I don't really follow sports in America living here. I used to watch basketball a lot, but I don't. And so those things are completely meaningless to me. But I would look at things here that probably don't matter to most people in America, but Brexit, the French elections, the Dutch elections, the German elections, you know, I look at those and say, okay, those are all occurring in the same sort of context, the same global economic context, the same issues right. about the fourth, was it the fourth revolution?
Fourth turning.
No, I'm not. I don't mean, in this case, I don't mean the fourth turning. I'm talking about we had the Industrial Revolution
fourth,
and
right?
The artificial intelligence, basically the rise of artificial intelligence, the rise of robots, robotization. And I don't mean robots like they're going to come all kill us.
You mean automation?
Yeah, just automation, the effect of automation. And so there's a lot of jobs that have been lost to that, or, you know, certain jobs are no longer paying well, not only because of things going to China, you know, so there are many areas where the rich have become wealthier and the poor have become poorer. The middle class is being, you know, somewhat squeezed. And so those have an effect throughout the globe. And so I can look at, so I should have been able to look at Brexit and say, maybe even though that was happening in UK and there's all sorts of different historical context to it, it could have been a bit of an indicator of what was happening in the US. And is what happened with Brexit and the US now, should I take that as a serious indicator for France and Germany? And it may not even mean that they will go to a more radical form of government, but it may be that at least their opposition parties will rise. Their nationalist parties are rising. You know, so those, I think, are linked, you know, linked events. So it's like, where are they linked and where are they unlinked?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I think it's a really good point. It certainly is the case that right now there are a lot of unusual things happening. I mean, climate change is one. We're seeing climate refugees. There's a level of income inequality that has not been seen for a very long time. There are a lot of unusual things that may be interacting in a way that produces very unusual results.
Yes.
That aren't black.
But they're explicable.
Exactly.
They're explicable. Yeah. There's a pattern that's underlying them all.
Yes, that's right. It is not as this may be different, and we're still learning how to predict them because there's a lot of weird stuff out there, a lot of unusual things, and we're all sort of trying to figure out, all right, how do these things work together, and what are the consequences of these new kind of models with very radical variables? But they're explicable.
I just thought of I actually did just think of something that may link to the Oscars, and this may be trying to fit something that doesn't make sense, but I had
it's
heard
pareidolia, I think, yeah, finding pattern and noise.
Yeah.
Yeah, go.
But I heard that the person who handed the wrong envelope or whatever had been, I don't know whether he had been texting, he had been making selfies backstage. And those were basically distractions that wouldn't have happened 15 or 20, let's say 20 years ago. There wouldn't have been even cell phones out.
But let me understand, you're saying that Trump got elected because voters were taking selfies with Emma Stone.
Yeah. Precisely.
Yeah, I think that's probably
that's
right.
Pretty much
I think
it.
Metaphorically, figuratively. Yeah.
That's probably the most likely explanation.
But it does tie into just a distracted employee. You know, and that may have had some contributing factor. And in the case of Trump, I would say that the use of social media helped propel him to the presidency, but also his, I would say, misuse of it during the presidency could cause problems. So his tweets have caused problems. They've caused political problems. And so in a way you could say, okay, he's caused political problems by tweeting things about countries, and somebody either tweeting or making selfies may have made them distracted to the point that they handed the wrong envelope. Now the consequences of a wrong envelope compared to, you know, bombing a country are pretty major. Mm-hmm. but there's this small thread running through.
Yeah. All right. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week, probably talking a little more Trump, but I think I'd actually like to talk a little bit about the French elections. There have been some developments with Marine Le Pen that we were talking about a little bit before the podcast. I'd actually like to see what is going to happen in North Korea as well. Maybe talk about that a little more. Scott, you said last week, actually, I like the idea of each week predicting what may be the big story next week. I think last week we thought it would be the executive order?
Yeah,
which didn't happen. What do you guys think about this week? What do you think is going to be the big story this week?
We could still get an executive order. I mean, I think that's a good contender. They delayed it a week.
Okay, all right. So let's make a contingent on. If there's an executive order, do you think it's materially similar? Well, it's going to be materially similar. Do you think it's very similar to the previous executive order? Do you think there's a real attempt to comply with the issues the Ninth Circuit identified? Do you think it's superficial changes and like we're going to force this through?
I think it will certainly be watered down to the point that it won't say talk about minority religions in the countries. I think that would have to go if they have any sense.
I think it will be facially legal, although still somewhat more sloppily written than a typical executive order.
It's probably the case.
And I think it will still include those seven countries, even though realistically there's other countries with greater threats. And
but they're going to take Iraq out?
There's talk of removing Iraq.
Of Iraq, okay.
Yeah.
But keep Iran in just because they've never sent anybody bad.
Why not?
Yeah. I think it'll still be discriminatory in intent, and that will ultimately get judiciated.
I wish they would litigate. I wish they would have appealed to the Supreme Court. So it would be interesting to see what the Supreme Court does with it. Because it's very much, and we talked about this part of the podcast and some emails. One of the things politically that we will talk about at some point, and I'd like to do some forecasts about as well, is gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is becoming, I mean, obviously we have the census coming up. It's becoming a much bigger issue. This is the idea that gerrymandering is associated with a lot of the polarization of politics. There's a story today about how Obama is getting involved with this new organization that's been set up to combat gerrymandering. But in the short term, there was a recent decision. I don't remember the jurisdiction. Oh, it was a Supreme Court decision, but I don't remember which jurisdiction that it came from about gerrymandering. There's an expected Supreme Court decision. I think it's either this year or next year. I feel like it's actually at the end of this term about gerrymandering as well. And I think it would be interesting to talk about that and just sort of make some forecasts about where that's going. Because obviously it's going to be material to our political system, but it also seems to be something that is much more visible than it used to be even a year or two ago. Okay. All right. So you can reach us at nonprofitspod@gmail.com, nonprofitspod.wordpress.com. If you like us, recommend, give us 4.5 to 5 stars, whatever platform you're listening to.
Or even 2 if you're having a bad day. You can give us 2.
Don't say
that. Don't encourage you to say that.
Sorry.
Hey, no. We're all about truth. We're all about truth.
Be honest. Yes. Just not too
not
honest.
Super honest.
Be kind.
Be kind. We'll talk to you next week. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.